This program, a production of the North Carolina Reading Service, is designed for listeners who are blind or print impaired, and it is the Independent Indie Week, a weekly publication read by John Federson today. The issue dated April the 30th of 2026. Well, first off, from St. Augustine's University in Raleigh, not a wished-for event, but one that was fairly well decided that it was going to happen, and that's bankruptcy. St. Augustine has declared bankruptcy and announces an interim president's resignation. It filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy on Monday, and announced on Tuesday its interim president, Dr. Jenny Ward Robinson, had resigned after about 4 months on the job. The 159-year-old Raleigh HBCU had been struggling for years with mounting debt and declining enrollment. Leadership turnover and financial mismanagement exacerbated the university's problems. SAU lost accreditation in 2025 and tried to sue its accreditor to regain it, a last-ditch effort the school now says it has dropped. Last summer, then, interim president Marcus Burgess said the university's debts exceeded $47 million. According to this bankruptcy filing, SAU now owes somewhere between $50 and $100 million to 345 different creditors, including vendors, financial lenders, former students, and multiple federal agencies. Filing for bankruptcy imposes an automatic stay that pauses debt collection, lawsuits, and foreclosures against SAU. According to court documents, the goal of SAU's Chapter 11 is to develop a plan of reorganization approved by the court that describes how the university will settle its debts and move forward. In the meantime, SAU cannot sell off its property or enter into significant financial agreements without the court's approval. The university wrote in a press release on Tuesday, "This structured court-supervised process will enable SAU to organize its financial affairs in an orderly and transparent manner. The decision made by the Board of Trustees reflects a deliberate and strategic step to advance the university's long-term sustainability while addressing current financial realities. SAU will develop this plan of reorganization with the support of, quote, its primary lending partner, that's Help Ventures Fund, according to the press release. WRAL reported in January that Self-Help, a local nonprofit lender, assumed some of SAU's debt and offered the university a lower interest rate. Quote, Self-Help believed in the mission and legacy of St. Aug's when we provided this lifeline financing at the very end of 25, and we still believe in the mission and potential of the school going forward. That's a Self-Help CEO Martin Eakes told the Indy on Tuesday. And we think that the Chapter 11 process will give the university enough time to put a sustainable plan back into operation. Per this press release, SAU's board has appointed Dr. Virginis A. Peoples to be the new interim president. The release did not give a reason for Ward Robinson's resignation, and a university spokesperson declined to respond to the Indy's questions on that subject. Ward Robinson did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Peoples was previously SAU's interim provost and vice president of academic affairs. She briefly served as interim president in 2025. Between Burgess' resignation and Ward Robinson's hiring, she is SAU's ninth president or interim president in 10 years. The university also announced on Tuesday that it will stop its legal battle to regain accreditation from the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges. That's SACSCOC. SACSCOC revoked SAU's accreditation in July of 25, and the university has been fighting that decision ever since. A higher education expert told the Indy at the time that lawsuits to regain accreditation are rarely successful. The press release read, after careful evaluation, the board determined that continuing litigation would not be a prudent use of resources. SAU will instead focus on supporting students through teach-out agreements, developing non-degree certificates and apprenticeship programs, and building a pathway toward reaccreditation. The institution reached this conclusion in cooperation with its accreditor, SACSOC, to ensure impacted students were able to graduate from an accredited institution. Without accreditation, the value of a degree from SAU drops, but very few students reportedly remain enrolled to be affected by the change. The private university did not respond to Indy's questions about current students, but referred us to its FAQ page, which says remaining students, quote, will need to finish their degrees at another accredited institution, unquote. A spokesperson emphasized SAU will continue operating during bankruptcy proceedings and says the SAU will continue to offer technology and nursing certifications. For small schools that lose accreditation, the most common outcome is permanent closure, but a handful have made comebacks against the odds. Morris Brown College in Atlanta, HBCU, lost accreditation in 2002 due to financial mismanagement and filed for bankruptcy in 2012. It stayed open, fundraised, negotiated to get some of its debts forgiven, and brought on new leaders. The college regained accreditation in 2020, and enrollment has reportedly rebounded from 20 to over 400. Other financially troubled small colleges have merged with bigger, more stable institutions to stave off closure. Next, another education article. Woes now at the high school level, and this is from Durham High School. Record numbers of high schoolers there are missing school. Over half of Durham public high schoolers were chronically absent in the first 6 months of this current school year. Yet another challenge for a district already facing state underfunding and declining enrollment. Board member Natalie Byer said, "In no way are we where we need to be with this data and with our students. This is grim. It's just embarrassing for Durham to be this egregiously bad." Students are deemed chronically absent when they miss school for 10% or more of the academic year, no matter what the reason. Missing half a day or more of school counts as one absence. Short-term suspensions are included in the tally, but long-term suspensions are not, according to administrators. By state law, children aged 7 to 16 must attend school, and parents are responsible for their attendance. While absenteeism rates were highest for high schoolers, absences were also high across all grades. Roughly 37% of all students in the district were chronically absent in the first 6 months of this school year. Missing students are a relatively new challenge for the district, which saw attendance rates plummet following the pandemic. In 2018-19, almost 19% of students across the district were chronically absent. Since the pandemic, absenteeism rates have remained high, peaking at 41% in the 21-22 school year. Last year, Durham Public recorded a chronic absentee rate of 36%, the highest among the state's 12 largest school districts. This number outstrips rates across the state and nationwide, which are recorded at around 24% and 22%, respectively. School board member Joy Harrell Goff said there are complex reasons why students might miss school. Quote, We have babies that are staying home, taking care of their siblings so their parents can find work. When we're talking about removing barriers, it's not always just the barrier of students choosing not to engage in school. The absenteeism numbers reflect stark demographic differences. Laverne Mattox Perry is Senior Executive Director of Student Support Services, and she said, DPS aligns with the national and state trends, which consistently show that historically marginalized student groups experience higher rates of chronic absenteeism than their white peers. Since the 21-22 school year, over 40% of black and Hispanic students have been chronically absent from Durham schools, with each group exceeding statewide rates by around 10 percentage points annually. So far this year, absences among Hispanic students are higher still. Among those students, chronic absenteeism spiked at an 8-year high of 47% in the first 6 months of this school year. Likewise, 52% of the district's English language learner students were chronically absent. Students with disabilities were also disproportionately affected, with 44.7% of those students chronically absent, up from 23.9% in the 2018-19 school year before the pandemic. As part of wider campaign efforts to promote attendance, the district plans on hosting the Greater Durham Attendance Summit this summer. Beyer argued for a broader community effort. Quote, do we need a Durham-wide campaign about this? Representative Morey, some states have done statewide attendance campaign, she said, addressing the state legislator sitting in the back of the boardroom. State Rep. Marcia Morey, who attended the meeting in a white blazer, nodded. I don't know if that comes from legislation, but I'm sure they'll fund it, Bayer added with a dry chuckle. Administrators also hope that focusing on restorative practices will help resolve this attendance crisis. Chanel Sidbury, Assistant Superintendent for School Support. We want to move from reacting to absences to preventing them early. That means we need to act within the first few absences instead of letting them stack up. The district is working with the Elna B. Spalding Conflict Resolution Center, a local nonprofit organization, to conduct truancy mediation, a restorative process that brings families and schools together to, quote, identify root causes and create shared, actionable solutions to improve daily attendance. This year, 132 students were referred to truancy mediation, more than double the number the year before. Of those students, 58 had logged more than 30 absences at the time of their referral. Now, sticking with Durham, Durham could impose a 2-year data center moratorium. They could be the latest municipality in the Triangle to temporarily pause any data center construction. The City Council is expected to hear a proposal for a 2-year moratorium on data centers, data processing facilities, and cryptocurrency mining during its May 4th meeting. Supporters of the proposal plan to rally at City Hall before a public hearing is held. Under the proposal, the 2 years would be used to study the impacts of those facilities, during which time the council would be prevented from approving any development of them. The moratorium's goal is to allow the city to research, develop policy, and create legislation. City Council Member Nate Baker, who is bringing this proposal, said the moratorium would allow the city to establish regulations for data centers which can have, quote, a number of detrimental impacts, unquote. Large hyperscale data centers which support massive storage and processing and can train and run AI are of particular concern. Baker said during the council's Thursday work session, this is about being conservative, proactive on a rapidly changing and evolving issue before it becomes a problem here in our city. We're just trying to take a cool, calm, collected approach to this issue. The proposal will come 3 weeks after Apex approved a one-year moratorium on data centers and 2 weeks after Orange County did the same. Chatham County also enacted a one-year moratorium earlier this year. The temporary bans are similarly designed to allow officials time to gather research and approve regulations for these centers. According to an agenda memo from Baker to the City Council, Durham has observed a recent increase in inquiries, and potential applications for data centers and cryptocurrency mining operations. As Durham's ordinance outlines, it will give the city time to, quote, develop zoning standards and mitigation methods for these intensive land use types, which may cause detrimental harm to the natural environment and the quality of life of city residents. It will also allow the city to update its Unified Development Ordinance, which designates property zoning, to include data centers under its regulations. A number of Durhamites have organized to support the moratorium. One of them, Leslie St. Dre, the founder of a local housing and environmental justice group, Community, Land, and Power. The group has led the way in creating the Stop Data Centers in Durham Coalition, which is advocating for this ordinance. Sandre said they are hoping for the longest and strongest moratorium Durham can pass. And Sandre said, we need more people to understand the harms of AI to mental health, to the economy, to folks that are already over-policed, to the ways that ICE is using the data from AI. We're hoping to start talking to more people about those intersections, too. Sandre said some of their concerns lie with air, water, and noise pollution from data centers, in addition to the amount of energy and land that they require. These are concerns Bonita Green, president of the Merrick Moore Community Development Corporation, shares. Merrick Moore already deals with noise pollution from Interstate 885, Green said, something the community does not want to exacerbate. And if the moratorium passes, Green said, she hopes the city will use the 2 years to conduct, quote, true and honest research about the impacts hyperscale data centers could have, as well as share that information transparently. Green said she would also like there to be accountability for companies to not pass on costs or clean up to residents. Quote, I feel that our elected officials need to show a little bit more empathy and concern for people and not just looking at upfront revenue, said Green. Last year, Sharla Rios, a Durham resident and artist, co-curated a local exhibit that explored the relationship between AI, fascism, and climate disaster. Rios said she is concerned with the amount of water data centers consume, particularly while the Triangle is experiencing a drought. Another concern, she said, is energy use and future costs, as Duke Energy is proposing a 15% rate hike. Rios said, I would like us to really be critical and thoughtful and intentional and slow down and think about how big tech is impacting us currently and understand the future is not defined. It's defined by us. It's easy to feel like it's settled. AI is here. You adopt it. You get in line or you're going to get left behind. And that is not necessarily the case. The proposed moratorium will be brought to the City Council next week, at which time council members can pass or fail this temporary ban. While the council didn't discuss the moratorium during its work session last week, Mayor Leo Williams indicated he will support the measure. Next, what are flock cameras? The article is called, What the Flock? An Explainer. George Hogan has a mission to stop the Apex Police Department from renewing its contract with Flock, which sells automatic license plate readers, ALPRs, or cameras that can track cars by license plate number. Hogan said during a recent town council meeting, Last night I was taking my kids to gymnastics, a 6-minute drive. He said, On that drive, Apex Police and Flock photographed my car 50 times. Flock cameras capture 6 to 12 images of each car that passes, noting the car's make, model, color, and, quote, unique features like roof racks and bumper stickers, according to the company's website. That information is then stored in a central database along with data from tens of thousands of other cameras across the country, creating a widespread network for tracking drivers. Hogan said the standard for Apex cannot be, is this technically legal? The standard has to be, is this wise, necessary, is this who we are? Apex is not alone. Hundreds of flock cameras are deployed around the triangle according to crowdsourced maps, and neither is Hogan alone. Residents in Hillsborough and Pittsburgh have recently raised concerns about the cameras. The town of Hillsborough canceled its flock contract last year, quote, due to concerns about data privacy, unquote. And Chatham County canceled its contract just last week, ABC 11 reported. Hogan told Indy, We don't have the volume of crime that warrants a surveillance system that observes everyone, anywhere, at any time. There's no justification in Apex, no justification anywhere in North Carolina. The ultimate outcome here is that they, flock cameras, need to be removed. Apex approved its contract for 10 flock cameras in July 14th of 2025, and the cameras were installed later that year. That contract expires in January 27, unless the town council renews it. Apex Police Chief Ryan Johansson says these ALPRs help track stolen cars, which are connected to a, quote, vast majority of crimes committed in Apex. And he said this during a work session in January of this year. Since Apex signed its contract with Flock, however, news outlets, civil liberties organizations, and amateur sleuths have revealed the misuse of the system in other towns across the United States, prompting community pushback. In May of 25, news broke that ICE was accessing data from Flock's nationwide network of cameras through local police departments. That same month, tech news site 404 Media reported that a Texas police officer had searched the Flock network for a woman who had had an abortion. In November, an investigation by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, that's EFF, found that more than 50 law enforcement agencies had used Flock to monitor protests, including No Kings demonstrations. Jay Stanley, a senior policy analyst with the ACLU, Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, said, We worry that essentially it is mass surveillance. It collects data on passing cars, he added, without individualized suspicion of any wrongdoing. I don't think Americans would love it if there was a police officer standing on their street 24 hours a day writing down every time they drove by. And not only somebody on their street, but on every block in the city writing down everywhere they're going. And yet, that's basically what this technology does. In response to a request for comment, Flock spokesperson Holly Balin wrote in an email to the Indy Flock that, quote, Flock builds its products with privacy in mind. We believe public safety and privacy can coexist when technology is designed thoughtfully and backed by accountability. Around town, you can spot flock cameras by looking for small, rectangular black boxes mounted on tall poles, typically alongside small solar panels. Police don't generally release the locations of these because it would allow people to circumvent the system, but they are often posted at major intersections or thoroughways or throughways. Johansson said the Apex places ALPRs in areas where more crime occurs. One concern that Stanley has, though, is that these cameras will be disproportionately deployed in low-income neighborhoods or neighborhoods of color, as has historically been the case with law enforcement surveillance. In the past, police departments have used ALPRs locally, checking data against hot lists of cars that were stolen or associated with criminal activities. What makes Flock different is its cloud service. Stanley said, the company gives you the option of having the ability to search not just the data collected by your devices locally, but also devices in your state or across the country. And you can only do the nationwide searches if you allow your data to be, in turn, searchable nationwide. Activists and civil liberty organizations across the country have obtained public records that give an incomplete picture of how Flock cameras are being used. One data set from the Danville, Illinois Police, for example, shows instances when its Flock cameras were included in searches by other law enforcement agencies, including in North Carolina. More than 85 North Carolina agencies searched Danville's Flock cameras from June 24 to May 25, including the Raleigh and Fuquay-Varina Police Departments, according to the data set. One search by Raleigh Police covered more than 6,200 Flock networks, including Danville's, and more than 60,000 devices, the data shows. Across Raleigh, some 60 Flock cameras are in place, according to DFLOC, an open-source mapping project that allows community members to report the location of ALPRs. They are mostly spread out across the city, including downtown, North Hills, Millbrook, and Six Forks Road. But not all Flock cameras are owned or operated by local police departments. Some are owned by private businesses, homeowners associations, or residents. The Raleigh Police Department owns and operates only 32 of those cameras, according to its Flock, quote, transparency portal. Most suburbs of Raleigh also have Flock cameras. In addition to the 10 in Apex, there are a dozen or so in Cary, including 7 set up around local Lowe's and Home Depot stores. Lowe's and Home Depot, which have shared Flock data with law enforcement, are often the target of immigration raids, including one in Cary in November of 2025. Cary police doesn't own or operate these Flock cameras, according to town business specialist Colette Sweeney, but Cary police can access them due to an agreement with private property owners that took effect in March of last year. Garner Police owns and operates 20, according to its transparency portal, while the Fuquay Police have 16. There are also between 20 and 30 cameras in Holly Springs, Nightdale, and Wake Forest, according to DFLOC. Meanwhile, Durham has about 46 cameras, none owned or operated by Durham Police, and there are another 23 around Raleigh-Durham International Airport and Briar Creek. While ICE does not have official access to Flock cameras, reporters have found that individual police officers have conducted searches of the Flock system on behalf of federal immigration enforcement officials. Because many local police departments share their data in Flock's nationwide network, they were effectively able to search cameras across the country on behalf of ICE. Usage logs show information about the agency conducting the search, officer's name, time of search, license plate searched, which is often redacted, and the justification for the search. Indy found that ICE was listed as the reason for at least two searches by Raleigh police from September of 24 to February of 25, according to usage logs obtained by others through public requests and published on Muckrock. The RPD also conducted searches for specific FBI cases, although the majority of searches were for, quote, wanted person. The Indy didn't find any evidence that Kerry cameras had been searched on behalf of ICE. Examining usage logs provided by the town in response to a public records request, only one search of that more than 3,000 conducted by Kerry PD between March 1st of 25 and April 15th of 26 seemed related to a federal investigation, with a note that read just Fed case. While Apex Police allow its data to be searchable by other law enforcement agencies, quote, we only share with local police departments who know we are engaged in the same business we are, said Police Chief Johansson at that January work session. We do not share with federal entities, hard stop. We don't share our data with the FBI or DHS. We don't share it with ICE. We just don't do it. The Indy submitted public records requests for flock usage logs from RPD, Durham, Apex, and Kerry. The Raleigh and Apex requests are pending, while Durham said flock usage logs, quote, constitute a record of a criminal investigation and are not public records. Kerry PD provided usage logs but did not include information about the license plate numbers searched or the specific time and date of searches, citing the same North Carolina law that protects certain information from becoming public because it's part of a criminal investigation. The usage logs show about 3,200 searches conducted by Kerry PD in little more than a year. Now, roughly 40% of those were connected to a specific case number, but another 58 included no notes about why the search was conducted. Apex, meanwhile, performed thousands of flock searches, all with the search reason redacted, between August of 25 and March of 26, according to usage logs obtained by independent watchdog Have I Been Flocked and shared with the Indy. Dave Massas, investigations director for the EFF, in police departments across the country, search reasons can be blank or vague. EFF, by the way, is a national nonprofit that, quote, defends civil liberties in the digital world. Mass saying there are millions of searches where there's not even enough information to determine whether the search was valid or not. Back in Apex, the police department has taken some steps to address these concerns. At the January work session, Johansson said he had created a standard operating procedure requiring officers, quote, to enter a case number or an incident number and a detailed description of the reason they're accessing that database to run a license plate. As more people push back against flock cameras in their communities, some local governments have refused to renew their contracts with the company, while some states have put in place laws to restrict the use of ALPRs and address privacy issues. Others, including local police like Apex, have put safeguards in place in an attempt to address community concerns about privacy. But in Mass's opinion, no number of safeguards is enough. And he said, you can add training on and say, don't do this. You can add two-factor authentication. You can have an audit system in place. You can reduce the retention period of the data from 30 days to 2 days or 1 day or even 30 seconds. But even once you've done all that and it is really, really narrow, who can access the ALPR system ultimately. You're still reliant on the third-party company. If that data is still there, it can be abused. Okay, how about this article? A Raleigh writer's new memoir revisits the culinary school trenches. This concerns a book, Salt, Sweat, and Steam Reading, a reading which was given yesterday by my calendar, April 28th at 6:30 p.m. at Quail Ridge Books. Salt, Sweat, and Steam, a new memoir from Raleigh food writer Bridget Washington, opens with a crushing breakup that drives Washington to overhaul her life and enroll in culinary school at 26. The rest of the memoir traces more extremes of experience. In one chapter, Washington and her classmates find themselves dancing on the tables of the Michelin three-star institution 11 Madison Park, while famous chefs spray champagne. In another, she loses a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity over a paperwork fluke. Throughout, she fields a wide spectrum of feedback from her instructors at the Culinary Institute of America, where the book is largely set. Just as one professor offers Washington an approving nod, another calls her a goddamn pirate. That's a dig at her Trinidadian background when she does a sloppy job of filleting a black bass. Many don't seem to talk in a regular register. They bark, bellow, and huff. Washington attended culinary school in the late aughts, before the industry's recent referendum on kitchen culture that has toppled chefs like Noma's René Redzepi and seen The Bear eclipse tyrant-glorifying shows like Hell's Kitchen as the defining vision of restaurant life on screen. That backdrop is top of mind when reading Salt, Sweat, and Steam, which publisher Macmillan has billed as The Devil Wears Prada for the Yes Chef generation. That said, the memoir stops well short of condemning the school or the industry at large. Washington writes without much retrospective judgment and, in conversation, pushed back on the notion that the behavior of some school leadership amounted to a normalized culture of abuse. She serves as vice chair of the James Beard Foundation Journalism Committee. She authored a cookbook, Coconuts, Ginger, Shrimp, Rum, Caribbean Flavors for Every Season, in 2017, and contributes recipes to Bon Appetit and the New York Times, among other publications. She got her first taste of journalism during doing undergrad at North Carolina State University, writing for The Technician. At culinary school, she became editor-in-chief of the student paper, La Papillote. Ahead of these upcoming reading, which actually happened already, at Quail Ridge, the Indie spoke with the author about harsh teaching methods, life after culinary school, and where to eat in the Triangle. And it notes here that the interview, which is in Q&A form, has been edited for length and clarity. So, first question. You describe some verging on abusive tactics from your instructors at the culinary. As you've gotten distance from that experience, how do you look back on the teaching methods? Washington. I grew up in Trinidad, went to high school there, and to answer the question, I have to answer it within the context of my formative education, which was based off the English system, where there was corporal punishment. I remember as a younger student playing with an ink cartridge and getting ink all over my page, and my teacher was horrified. She took a ruler and whacked me a couple times on my knuckles. I remember exactly what she said. It looks like a cockroach dipped in ink and ran across this page. And then she gave me pop, 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 three taps on my knuckles. From then on, my penmanship was very neat and tidy. Because that was my cultural touch point, I was better able to manage. I had the tools to manage this sort of education at Culinary Institute because it mirrored what I knew. I didn't think it was 100% the same for everyone. Do you have thoughts on how effective that kind of harsh, sometimes humiliating approach is as a teaching method versus something softer? You write about a mix among the instructors at the Institute. I think it's not either or. It's very much a both and. If it was too gentle, I wouldn't have learned as much as I did. There were times when I thought I wanted gentle, and it would not have been good for me. But when I most needed gentle, gentle was there. Where's the line? It's hard to draw a definitive line with something that is truly unquantifiable. It goes on to somebody else's experience. For instance, with my two children, our son Luke is very tough, very rough and tumble. If I look at my daughter a certain way, she will cry. When we have to reprimand her, it's a very long process. I think it's just a microcosm of the large experience. It's an impossible line to be drawn because literally every person has a different experience. From a more systemic perspective, I think we've seen when instruction is delivered in a volatile way, it can shape the kitchens that some of these big-time culinary graduates go on to run. A number of chefs who came up under René Redzepi, for instance, went on to run kitchens with their own abuse allegations. Do you have thoughts on that lineage? Temperament does not necessarily mean tradition. There's multiple other factors that inform a landscape other than the temperament of the chef instructors that taught a new bumper crop of chefs. I wrote a lot about a culinary school instructor named Chef Leroux. There's a restaurant in Chicago from a former student, and he named his restaurant Leroux because how engaging and personable and warm our professor was. And the opposite is true, which I think is your question. But at the same time, we kind of pigeonhole because culinary school has a very militaristic command over how education is dispersed. That doesn't necessarily mean those are how those restaurants are run. It's kind of correlation is not equal causation. So it's important to consider the nuance there and also consider the personality of the chefs. We could use Redzepi as an example, but there are hundreds of thousands of other chefs who are the diametric opposite of him, and that's part of what I wanted to get across in the book. It's very careful to delineate exactly why someone's temperament is the way it is, and while it may inform how a restaurant is run, it's not necessarily the source of that. You describe the curriculum as firmly rooted in the French tradition, and you write that when it does venture beyond that, the treatment sometimes feels shallow. In the years since you were there, the industry has decentered the French culinary tradition. For instance, the Michelin Guide is less dominated by French restaurants than it used to be. Do you have a sense of whether the culture or the curriculum at the school has shifted? I can't definitely speak directly to the culture, but I can say yes, the curriculum has, and that does reflect, as you said, a more robust, cultural awareness. But I think, too, there is that formative element. If we're studying architecture, I would imagine that a lot of the formative lessons would be tilted toward European design because they've just been doing it longer. And I think similarly, the curriculum at culinary followed that historical pattern. After you graduated, did you spend any time working in restaurants or did you go straight into food writing? I actually did restaurant consulting. Joseph was working the 9-to-5, and I didn't want to not see my new husband. I wanted to be able to be at home and not work on the line. There was a great little restaurant in our neighborhood called the Ginger Man, and I was just like, what's your biggest problem right now? And they said, this, and this was like, okay, I think I can help you solve it. There was actually one story in this book that my editor and I took out because the timing was wonky, but it's a good anecdote. That restaurant, the Ginger Man, they had several cases of Opus 1, which I'm not sure if you know much about wine or Opus, but it's a pretty expensive wine, a very good Bordeaux. They had several cases of it, and the owner was worried that people aren't buying it because it's $300 to $400 a bottle. The restaurant was celebrating a milestone birthday, and the owner was like, how do we move this? I remember I emailed my old wines professor from culinary, Professor Weiss, and he said, tell them to sell it by the ounce. Sell it at $10 an ounce, because what happens is that people will buy 1 ounce, and they will buy three or four more. But if you put $50 in a glass, no one is buying that. The reason I was disappointed that this didn't make it into the book was because it showed that professors there are truly bought into their students' success long after they graduate. The owner was over the moon. He sold out all his cases. Question. When you were at NC State, you wrote for the Technician and a culinary. You became the editor-in-chief of the student newspaper Le Papillote. How did the school publications shape your path as a journalist? I think it's really important that everyone, for whatever amount of time is possible, you do a job you love for little money at all. Because I think that really cements the, why am I doing this? Writing for the Technician was rewarding. I appreciated the discipline. Things I didn't want to cover, like Rush and Frat Week, it was like, you have to cover it. So in those moments, it was appreciating, okay, let me try to understand this history. Let me take a step back. I think that is really gave me that bedrock of like, this is the importance of being socially curious. Question, are there certain techniques or ways of doing things you've retained from culinary school that you find yourself putting into practice day to day when you cook at home? Absolutely. How to properly sear, how to use a fond, how to deglaze, all those very old-school traditional French techniques. It's still part of how I cook today. When I'm making a stock, it's always a lazy bubble because you don't want to emulsify the fats. What are your go-to places to eat in the Triangle? Well, it's different if we have the children with us. They love going to Five Star in Raleigh, next to the train tracks. When it's Joseph and I, the chefs who are just exceedingly thoughtful and nuanced, I find it to be the case at Aja, Brodetto, Peregrine, and Bombolo. The work behind the work is very visible. You can tell when the food is underwritten with scholarship. Unfortunately, my final article, Putting the Gold in Golden Years, by Billy Warden, is very long. Looks like 9, 10 pages. I won't be able to finish it. I'll do what I can. In between sneezes, that is. I do that because I have allergies, and they're creeping into the broadcast studio. Anyway, here we go. The team from Charlotte is graying and a bit stooped here and there, but as brassy as primetime Muhammad Ali when it comes to smack talk. We're back. We're better. We have no fear. Nothing can stop us. This is our year. The 8 men and 6 women ranging in age from 72 to 94 hail from the Barclay at South Park, one of the many senior living communities strewn across North Carolina and the Southeast like the gems embedded in a boxer's championship belt. The Barclay Battlers crossed 172 miles to compete against the elite squads from 11 other senior communities in the Carolinas, Tennessee, and Florida, owned and operated by Wilmington-based Liberty Senior Living. For 3 brisk days in March, Raleigh's Hayes Barton Place was host to the 5th annual Liberty Games. This year's competition featured 150 contenders in seated bowling and shot put, standing table tennis, and a bocce ball, a water balloon toss and a water balloon drop, Scrabble, bridge, and a handful of other contests spread across a heated indoor pool, putting green, and activity rooms. The showdown mirrors a fierce competition between senior living Shangri-Las to win the trust and treasure of the silver-haired set flocking to the state. According to the NC Office of State Budget and Management, by 2030, one of every 5 Tar Heels will be 65 or older. By the early 2040s, more residents will be over 65 than under 18. The game showed just how action-packed the active lifestyles at these facilities can be. In its marketing materials, Liberty promises a program, quote, to help residents improve all aspects of their physical, emotional, spiritual, and mental health. Society once called retirement havens rest homes. Today's upper echelon models are revved up and on the move. At Hayes Barton Place, an elaborate opening ceremony included a color guard and a keynote address from 2012 Olympic swimming gold medalist and friend of Michael Phelps, Charlie Hushin, a Raleigh native. But the pièce de résistance are the cheers, composed and vigorously delivered by each of the 12 competing squads. Tricked out in purple and teal jerseys, a la the Charlotte Hornets, and brandishing matching pom-poms, the Crown Town team knuckles down in the competition. We're back. We're better. We have no fear. Nothing can stop us. This is our year. On the second stanza, a few of the Barclay scrappers wag their index fingers squarely at the team from the Templeton of Kerry, who happened to be the three-time reigning champs. The wagging fingers send a lightning bolt zagging through the crowd. Some titter, some snort. The Templeton team is quiet, cool. They know, as one of the members later says, we have a target on our back. The effect is like Ali goading champion George Foreman on the eve of the Rumble in the Jungle, or Joe Willie Namath's guarantee of a Super Bowl victory. It's the stuff of legend, if Barclay lives up to it. From the podium, MC Haley Kinney-Norris watches the cheer, then wide-eyed chortles, "You pointed!" Ken Norris, Liberty's 30-year-old spark plug, corporate director of life enrichment and wellness, created these games as a celebration of camaraderie, sportsmanship, and connecting with peers. The boldness of the chant shouldn't come as a surprise. These are competitive and accomplished people, and their coaches have stoked the fire. ABT, says Anna Eagle, Barclay's wellness director, with a raise of an eyebrow. That could mean all about team. Could mean anyone but Templeton. And the athletes know time may not be on their side. Carpe diem indeed. We came in second at the last game, said 81-year-old Marilyn Prinsky. But we're much older now, deadpans her husband of six decades. Yes, Marilyn laughs, a year is a long time at our age. Well, to determine their lineups of the Liberty game, each community held hotly contested qualifying rounds. My parents, Bill and Nancy Warden, performed well in the water balloon drop. Gotta see what that's it. At Hayes Barton, where they've lived about a year. This contest involved ascending to a fifth-floor apartment and dropping softball-sized water balloons off the balcony with the intention of hitting a bullseye stretched out on the grass below. Right. Marilyn Prinsky is a quadruple threat, making the cut in shuffleboard, bridge, cornhole, and swimming, even though she only learned to swim a few months ago. Better late than never, she remarks. The Prinskys are baby chasers, that is, seniors who migrated to be near their families. They abandoned Tucson to be closer to their daughter and sole grandchild in Charlotte. That's her name is Charlotte. Marilyn grows like a kid herself, ambling between the themed food stations at the post-opening reception, from a low country shrimp boil to Tennessee brisket. A signature cocktail helps send all this down the hatch. That would be the gold medal margarita. Artie Linworth, 83, of Florida, is no stranger to medals, having earned a half dozen the previous games, gold and otherwise. He's a Liberty Games superstar, the event's own Mr. Sunshine, beloved for brightening each opening ceremony with a cartwheel. Since retiring from the chemical industry, Linworth has penned three self-help books, including Slice the Salami, Tips for Life and Leadership One Slice at a Time. He also teaches Tai Chi, which emphasizes balance, the best way to avert a broken hip. With a few of Linworth's friends ill, the Wellington Bay team was smaller than in previous years, but that doesn't dim his spirit. We're highly energized, eager for the win, he says. After the reception, he and other visiting competitors head off to the Hilton Raleigh North Hills, where they are lodging on the tab of Liberty, and 19 event sponsors, which include banks, healthcare providers, a wedding and elopement photography shop, and a purveyor of fitness equipment. Age doesn't define you, Lindworth offers before departing. Attitude does. It's a high-stake competition you seek? If it is, try developing and operating senior living facilities these days. There is nothing more difficult, says Michael Sandman, lead developer of the Cypress of Raleigh. It's incredibly complicated. The Cypress is officially called a Continuing Care Retirement Community, or CCRC. These are designed to accommodate seniors with a variety of needs, from independent living to on-site assisted care, should dementia or other debilitating malady take hold. But that's like describing a Lamborghini Bueno Roadster as a mere motor vehicle. Upmarket and CCRCs and senior living communities are retirement heavens, with soaring lobbies in place of pearly gates, small armies of attendants, a variety of eateries, and endless opportunities to exercise, socialize, and otherwise squeeze the most out of dear, sweet, precious life. Behind the polished marble and leafy courtyards, operators navigate complex regulatory and health care requirements. As if delivering all that isn't enough of a challenge, the product is pitched at one of the toughest audiences imaginable, discerning people of means, with competitors huffing down your neck or vaulting past you. Sandman describes the clientele as, quote, educated, sophisticated, and affluent with high expectations. Cypress opened in 2008, just in time for the retirement of the mighty baby boomer generation. The 80 million people expected to retire between 2007 and the early 2030s make up the silver tsunami. Well, our music is telling me I've got to go away now. I almost got finished with that, my final article, but I'll go home and read it. And how will I do that? Well, I'll look at IndieWeek.com online. All of these back issues going back decades are available there. And I might add, also here at ncreadingservice.org, where we store the Audible version of these for years. So, John Federson for North Carolina Reading Service, bidding you farewell for now. I'll be back with another issue of Indie Week next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Bye-bye.